Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Ilona Thompson, Palate Exposure, very bad voice. Apologies to the listeners, but there's no way I was going to change today because it's a very special day for me. I get to sit down with a person that embodies the word legend with respect to everything, not just Napa Valley, but viticulture and wine culture in general. I was fortunate enough to meet him at a judging competition last year in Sacramento, and I was entirely intimidated because I've only heard of him before, and I know what he means to the industry. And now he paved the way for all of us that touched wine in any shape or form. Fortunately for me, he is a profoundly gracious human being. And he agreed to sit down with me today and talk about his life story. Before we get into it, I'd like to point out that everyone that loves wine should be purchasing his book. It's called The Winemaker. It's one of the most compelling, if not the most compelling, reads when it comes to wine, life, wisdom, and everything that all of us could learn a great deal from. So I urge you to order it. It's available on Amazon. There'll be a link posted at the end of the podcast. I think you will learn a lot and you will gain a whole new appreciation for what the world wine world is and what it truly represents. There's many truths in it that rearranged my head. So please do that. You'll be grateful that you did. So first of all, thank you for having me. I want to start at the very beginning. You actually were born in the Midwest in Iowa.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So tell me a bit about your childhood, which I know, in and out of itself, we could have a whole show on that. it's a true American story.
We were very poor, but everybody else was too. In the 1930s, no one had any money, and when I started to think of this, I thought, well, poor beginnings. But that's not it. I don't measure success by money. I really don't. The fact that we didn't have any money and no one else did had nothing to do with it. We had a very good family life because we all had a job to do and we all did it. We raised, grew most of our own food. We had a 3-acre well, you can't call it a farm. A farm is not 3 acres. 3 acres does not make a farm. But that's what we had. And we had a cow and hogs, chickens, and we'd butcher a hog at least once a year. So I learned how to make bacon and ham and side meat and so on, cure it. And we had a garden a little over an acre. That was our garden, and that garden fed us the whole year round. We raised everything you could grow, and always experimented with something, one or two things every year. And I remember growing black carrots, and I haven't done that for a while. I think I will do that again here, maybe this year, because they're really nice.
Black carrots.
Schwarzwurzeln, they're just... It's something you don't have in this country, and it ought to be here. I'm surprised all the German immigrants that come into this country, and nobody seems to plant black carrots, but they're really nice. You have to peel them, and when you peel them, they look like asparagus. They're very white. It looked like white asparagus. The inside of the carrots is white, and so you peel off like a potato peeler. You just peel off the thin skin. And boil them, and a little butter, and it's a terrific flavor. Nothing at all like carrots, nothing like asparagus or or any of those garden vegetables. It's just got its own flavor. And we'd grow peanuts occasionally, something that we'd like to do just to see if you could do it. You know, nobody grows peanuts in Iowa, but I grew a few plants. All the vegetables you can think of, and my mom canned every year. And so from about, July to September, we were canning most days, 3 or 4 days a week. And so we all had jobs to do. We'd all work out in the yard and the garden. And having light complexion like you and me, I got sunburned all the time and never tanned. My ancestry is Nordic. My grandfather came from Sweden and grandmother from Germany, and the other grandmother from Germany both, so it's Northern European, and then we have a lot of British English in us, and Irish, of course. And so all of that, the Northern European, the Viking background in our ancestry shows up when you're out in the sun, because I didn't get sunburned, I got sun blistered just routinely. But a few days later, it would peel off, and then I'd new skin and start over. So that was all part of it. And we learned to do everything because you couldn't afford to pay anybody to do anything. So my dad knew how to fix everything because he didn't have any money and had to learn how to fix things. And he taught me the way if something breaks that you don't know what it is, you don't know how it works. What you do is you take it apart, one piece at a time, keep track of how you did it, and you take it apart far enough to understand how it works. Once you know how it works, fixing it is easy. You either clean something, usually it's cleaning, sometimes you replace a part. And so I grew up with that. So overall, I have to say I had a great beginning. The early life was not poor, it was rich.
Your mom and dad, you speak about them quite extensively in the book. They had a profound influence on who you became.
Uh-huh.
Tell us a little bit about that. Your mom was a very special lady.
Well, she could do everything, too. She taught me how to wallpaper walls very early, and for years I did that. I haven't done it in this house, but I always, for many years after that, I would always paper one wall of most of the rooms in whatever house I was in. And actually, I think I did it just to show off, just to show that I knew how to do it, because most people don't know how to paper walls. And it was quite a procedure. She took boards out of the dining room table, the expansion boards, and we used those as planks between two chairs. And you unrolled the wallpaper and cut out, you measured the walls, and of course no wall was straight, no wall was clean in our house. The house was built sometime in the 1890s, and this was 1930s, and so it was already an old house, no insulation in it in Iowa, just frame. And so most of the insulation in the building came from wallpaper. And so I'd have to go along first, and you'd tap on the wallpaper and see if there's hollow spots. If there's hollow spots, you cut it with a knife and pull off whatever is loose, whatever would come loose. And I remember counting 14 different layers from one piece that I pulled off. So we wallpapered every day, every spring. And by about June, we had it done. And we'd wallpaper the ceilings and all the walls. And that really is, it always surprised me. Even as a kid, it surprised me. A room without wallpaper was very, very cold in the wintertime. You could feel the wind blow right through the wood. It couldn't have been, but it was maybe through pores in the wood, maybe. Anyway, cold winters, I remember 20 below zero twice in my being a kid there growing up. And one day each time, but still it was 10 below routinely. And It got very cold in there, but if you wallpaper a room, all of a sudden it's a lot warmer than it was. And you think about it, wallpaper, I don't know how thick the paper is, but maybe four or five times as thick as newspaper, that thick. And you seal it up really quite well, and you fix all the cracks, and it does it. It really makes it warm in the winter. Most people don't know that because they don't have wallpaper or don't have to do it.
I am chuckling in my head right now because I never thought I'd be having this conversation, especially with you. But it so happens that I grew up in Eastern Europe, meaning Russia, meaning St. Petersburg, and I grew up in an apartment.
Oh, that's cool.
And like every apartment, it had wallpaper, and we did that every year. And people in this country just don't understand what it actually means. But you have to absolutely do it on a consistent basis.
Yes.
It gets pretty worn out and kind of messy looking after a while. And it's a matter of pride. So everybody had this kind of crazy decor in their little cubbyhole apartments in Russia. But I remember the wallpapering process with my grandma, and I'm utterly fascinated right now that we have that in common.
Very good. I didn't know that either.
I absolutely get it. Like I said, it's a lost art. I don't know of many homes in the United States that practices it. In fact, I probably don't know of any. I assume they exist, but it's quite a feat.
Among all my friends, I don't think I know even one who wallpapers walls,
yeah,
or who knows about it, knows how to do it.
Yeah,
I'm pretty good at it still, but I mean, I've done it for, you know, 30 years or more.
See, now I have an urge to ask you to have a wallpapering party.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I think I might qualify. I'm rusty, but at least I've done it. So the work ethic must have been just extraordinary growing up, doing everything with your hands, watching your parents and your siblings, but particularly your parents work so hard at making sure that you had, you know, everything that sustains a family.
Yes.
What mm-hmm. a powerful example.
Yes.
You moved to California at what age?
I came back from Korea. The Korean War was started in 1950, and
yeah.
I was just the right age. I was in college then, but I had a Navy ROTC scholarship. The only way I could go through college, I couldn't afford to do it otherwise, was I passed the test and got their highest program, which was they paid me $50 a month plus books and tuition to get through college. What I owed them for that after graduation was I owed them 3 years in the Navy or Marine Corps. I chose the Marine Corps because I wanted to fly so bad I could taste it, and one of the Marines that I met, the Marine officer that I met, was a pretty good salesman, I think. He told me that one out of four of the Marine officers are aviators. However, one out of five in the Navy are aviators. So I had a better chance of getting aviation in the Marine Corps than I would in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So I transferred in my senior year of college to the Marine section of Navy ROTC. So when I graduated, then I became a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. Well, the Korean War was on. It was 1952. And I went to Officers Basic School and then artillery school. They put me in artillery. I did not get aviation. And I hated them ever since for not giving me aviation, because I applied for it whenever I had a chance. I talked it up, and just before graduation from basic officer school, a flyer came in, a major who was a Marine Corps flyer, and he preached about how much fun it is to be flying and so on. Well, I think half of our class must have applied for aviation, and that was the only official application you had, and so I was only one of 400. There were almost 800 in our class, and I was one of maybe 400 applying, and my name didn't mean anything to them. They just drew names out of a hat, I think. Anyway, they needed artillerymen. The Marine Corps, or the Korean War, was a artillery war, and you know, some wars are tank wars, some wars are infantry war. This was an artillery war. They needed artillerymen, and I had always done well in math and science. And so I got put into artillery and not aviation. I disliked that Marine major for years, so much that I've forgotten his name totally, and I couldn't remember it now if I tried to, because he kept me out of aviation by preaching to everybody else. A lot of my friends got it, but I didn't. So when the Korean War ended into truces, was when I went over. I didn't have to. I didn't go. I didn't get out of artillery school until maybe 3 months or so after I got out of artillery school, was when the first truce happened. And I was not sent to Korea right out of artillery. I was sent to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, for the 2nd Marine Division in artillery. And I was only there a couple of months, and I got change of orders very rapidly. The war was really heating up in Korea. And it always happens just before a truce. Both sides are trying to gain as much land as they can. And so it was blistering battles. And the word came down that most of us are going to go to Korea, and we got to go right now. I had my car there, and I thought, well, I can drive to the West Coast faster than they can ship all these other guys there. But no, they would not allow that. We had to go by train, by troop train. So I had no time to do anything but park my car on the street and in Jacksonville, North Carolina, and we got on the troop train. Well, the troop train took about a week to get to camp, down in San Diego. I forgot the name of the base now. Anyway, it's a well-known Marine base, and I was unable to call my parents to have somebody go to North Carolina and pick up my car. And because the lights, you know, there were enough people were shipped to Korea right away because the war was so hot then, that all the telephone lines were down or were full. And I had no chance to call. I tried day and night, but I couldn't get through. And it was Kansas City. One of the stops that the train made was at Kansas City. I got off the train just long enough to call home, to call Des Moines, where they lived, or east of Des Moines, not in the city, but east of Des Moines, and told them about it, that they needed to come. And I had mailed the key to them, and so they'd gotten my letter with my car keys. And somebody in the family, I don't remember who, what went there and got my car. It was parked where I said it would be, and they drove it back for me. Well, on the way over to Korea, the first truce happened. All the hotness of the battle led up to the truce, and it was a 90-day truce, and I thought the war was going to start again. But it didn't. At the end of that, another 90-day truce took place. So while I was in Korea for a year, close to a year, there were four different truces, and each one was the extension of the last one. And we kept up our practice firings and so on, and were ready to go. And then a day or two before that, they announced that there was an extension of the truce. Finally, at the end, I gave up. They looked like the truce was going to last, and so the Marine Corps is always very, very cheap. They pride themselves on saving money for the country, and so as soon as it looks like they don't need the people anymore, and we were all over there then, and I was a battery executive officer of a firing battery, just right behind the Freedom Village, right at Munsan-ni, right at the my job, I remember, if the war started, was to take out that bridge. There's a bridge over the Imjin River, and our battery was assigned to blast that bridge apart if the enemy started coming down that way. And so that's what my job was, but I didn't have to do it. One of the announcements they made was that when we were coming back, they said, or we were scheduled to come back, but we were still in Korea, and they said that officers with at least 28 months or 27 months maybe of service, but had an obligation for 3 years, could resign their commission if they wanted to. And I talked to several of them, and they said, well, no, you're unlikely to get aviation now for a while. The main reason I had applied so many times that I finally called somebody in, I think it was Washington. Anyway, I got to speak to someone who was a part of assigning people their military assignments. And he said, well, the reason I did not get aviation in the Marine Corps is I was too young. And one of the things that happened when I was born in 1931, that was the bottom of the birth rate. It was the depth of the Depression, and the birth rate had gone to nothing. And so I didn't have anybody my age in life. I have never had anybody my age. There's only occasionally I'll meet somebody who's my age, but rarely. Most people are older or younger than me, and that's because there weren't many people born when I was born. So I resigned my commission and went into the Marine Reserve, and then went back to school. They told me that I had a GI Bill, and I said, no, I don't, because I had Navy ROTC to get me through school, the first college, and so I wouldn't qualify. And he said, no, you're wrong. He said, and this guy I do remember, Captain Wesley F. Demons, I remember, because he gave me such great news. He said that the GI Bill does not care how you got your commission. Right now, you can have 4 years of college if you want it. Even though you've already got 4 years of college, you can have 4 years. So I said, well, I'll take two of it. I'll get a master's degree. I'll go back and do that. Well, while I was in getting a master's degree, the school got a hold of me and said, no, you need to get a PhD. We want you to do this and that. And it was right. It was the best thing for me. So that's how I ended up getting so much schooling. And then during the school, I did research. I was in the food technology department, but most of the work I did was biochemistry. Loved biochemistry. Got to meet some famous people there and really got to enjoy it. I had three job offers waiting for me when I graduated with a PhD. I actually never had to apply anywhere. People came to the universities to get people in those days. The one I chose was Gallo, and that's how I got into the wine industry. 10 years earlier, that was 1958. 10 years earlier, 1948, when I was a freshman at Iowa State College, I went home one weekend in September to make my own wine. My dad had been a home winemaker during Prohibition, and that was a fascinating time because I found a bunch of wine bottles. They were champagne bottles, actually, and in our cave, and he told me all about it. But he didn't know any more than anybody else. Everybody was a home winemaker during Prohibition. Everybody. Interesting thing about Prohibition is that people thought that if you prohibit alcohol, it would solve all the problems. No, you wouldn't have all these drunks causing trouble and killing people and accidents and so on. You'd get rid of all that. That's not what Prohibition did to the country. Prohibition very quickly spawned a whole business sprang up. Well, two or three businesses sprang up, but one of them was home winemaking. Everybody became a home winemaker, and you could buy grapes from anywhere, and no one knew how to do it. There weren't any books on it. The cover of my book, The Winemaker, the cover of it shows a picture that my friend took of me at age 17 when I made that. So those grapes on that picture, that was my first experience making wine. I asked my dad how to do it, and he said, well, you smash grapes all to hell and filter it so that you get the stuff clean, let it spoil, of course, first, and then after it's finished bubbling, you filter it and put it into bottles, and you've got the wine made. So I went to the library and I found only two books on winemaking that he really didn't say very much more than he did, told me. So I told him he was right. That's how you do it. So I was like every other home winemaker, and I guess I've met hundreds, maybe 1,000 or more people who've made wine at home and who make wine at home today. They still do it. And every one of them, without exception, they truly believe that the wine they make at home would rank with the highest wines anywhere, made anywhere in the world at any time. Count clear back to the Romans, this wine is better. The best winning wines in all the competitions, my wine is better. Everybody who makes his own wine thinks that, and they still do. I judge every year over at Lodi, the home winemaking. There's quite an industry in California, home winemaking, and because good grapes are very available, unlike during Prohibition, when you didn't have any good wine grapes, you just had table grapes that you made wine out of. Well, anyway, I judge there every year, and it surprises me how good their wines are. They don't, though, rank with some of the highest wines in the world like they think they do. Well, that's how I got here. Anyway, that's how I got into California. I just stayed, is what I did.
Wow. No, thank you for sharing your story. And I just want to quick make a note about your military career and how hard-earned it is. I, again, would urge people to read in great detail how much you suffered during, you know, the initiation process. It was quite brutal. It wasn't all, you know, it sounds really heroic and patriotic, and it yes. was what mm-hmm. you did. But there's a dark side that I think, you know, it tells me a lot about your character, that you survived what a lot of us probably, you could have broken, most of us.
Yes, that's true. Now, you're referring to the first cruise I took as a Navy ROTC midshipman. That would have been 1949.
And you were so young.
We went down to Panama. Well, I hadn't been out of Iowa. Well, I'd been to Wisconsin, but that's hardly, that's not much out of Iowa, just across the river. So I got to take a train. And in fact, the same guy who took the picture on the cover of the book was in Navy ROTC also, and he went with me. We went on this cruise. We went aboard the light cruiser Springfield, CL-66. In San Francisco Bay, and went aboard, and then sailed out through the under the Golden Gate Bridge, and hung a left, and went down to Panama. And when we got down there, Panama is very close to the equator, and they took a day and went out to Galapagos Islands, right on the equator, and we didn't go ashore at all. But they only went out there to give us the hazing ceremony that people went through in those days. And whenever you cross the equator, you're a polywog before you go, and after you pass through the hazing procedure, you become a shellback. And of course, there are a lot of shellbacks on board the ship because they've gone through it before, and they are the ones who arranged it. And I thought they were SOBs. I mean, these people were mean to us. I thought, well, that's, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll have a lot of fun. Well, it wasn't. It was, and I do go into I show pictures even, because they took official pictures of this, and I bought a set right away, not knowing what I would do with them. But I just wanted to be able to show people what we went through. I was having migraine headaches at the time and didn't know it. I didn't understand what they were. I just knew that I got sick, I'd vomit. I mean, I just... And a severe, severe headache, and one side of my head or the other, you never knew which one. I didn't get them very often, but maybe once a month, something like that. And there were triggers. I not only didn't know that these headaches were migraines, but I also didn't know that they were triggered by certain things. They can be triggered in some people by dark chocolate. Well, I love dark chocolate, and it never did trigger a migraine on me. It just didn't do it.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.